Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the online streaming cinema. For your free 30-day trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage. Back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the movie review podcast for thefilmstage.com. This is a special bonus episode where we will be talking about the highlights of the 2018 Sundance Film Festival with two of our far-flung world-traveling correspondents who were able to go there. We have our benevolent Lord and Master, Jordan Raup.
Hello.
And my personal nemesis, Dan Mecca.
Hello, how are you?
I am great. So yeah, it happened again, as it does every year. Sundance came into our lives and filled film Twitter with all kinds of speculation. I understand that the 2019 Oscar race is already in full swing, which is just depressing. So let's talk about it. Before we do, though, remember you can find us on Twitter at Film Stage Show, Facebook The Film Stage Show. Rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, and as always, give to our Patreon. That is patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. If you give us as little as $1 an episode, you'll help us to produce more great content, me to get a better computer, and hopefully you'll be able to get us to do some more episodes. We have classic reviews coming this month and every month to follow because of our Patreon subscribers. This month we'll be reviewing Paris, Texas by Wim Wenders. And since I already screwed up and said the name, might as well talk about Mubi, the online streaming cinema, where every day they introduce a brand new movie for you to enjoy. You have 30 days to watch, so you always have your rotating selection of 30 films. Coming to Mubi, it actually came yesterday, is a movie that I like to watch probably once a year, just because I love conspiracy theories and crazy people. And that is Room 237, the documentary slash visual essay about the various meanings that people found in Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. We also, as a part of the same whole thing that Mubi is doing, their Sundance favorites, we have Living in Oblivion. And Jordan, you told me that they are also going to be doing Ain't Them Body Saints by David Lowery, correct?
Yeah, that's already been on there for like a week, so get on it.
Get on it. And of course, Lover for a Day is in select theaters now. Go to loverforaday.mubi.com to find a full list of screenings across the country. One of our patrons in the Slack channel was telling us that Lover for a Day is playing near him in Pittsburgh, and he was elated. And he couldn't help but get some jabs in at Netflix, because while Netflix is snapping up high-profile stuff, it very rarely gets a theatrical release, and so he was thrilled that he'd be able to see this in theaters, thanks to Mubi. So again, go to loverforaday.mubi.com to see where that is playing, and go to Mubi, mubi.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial on us. So that's it. This is the part of the episode where I get to kind of stop talking, because I didn't go to the Sundance Film Festival. But Jordan and Dan, you both did. How was
it? Yes, we did.
How was the general atmosphere?
It was long. It was very long.
It felt long this year. Well, long for you. Right.
Yeah. I went with my, for my work, I went to Art House Convergence, which is like a CinemaCon kind of art house. You know, people who run theaters and stuff. And so, that was fun. I got to meet like 600 people that all are super passionate about independent film. But it just was, a very long trip.
I'm curious, did it feel long this year, not just because you were there for a longer amount of time, but were like the movies lesser? Were there more people? Was it just more of a hassle?
There didn't actually seem to be as many, like there wasn't as much of a hassle getting into screenings, and there was only a few that got shut out. I would say quality wise, the films were, you know, there was more, I would say, solid films, not as many flat out like great ones. I was talking to Dan about this, and usually every year there's maybe one or two films that'll sneak into my top 10 at the end of the year. And this year I could easily see some of these dropping out, but we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Sundance, you know, me and Jordan have been going for 8 years now for the film stage, and the festival does a great job, really, of like logistics. You know what I mean? It is basically really easy to get places, all things considered, snow and what have you. So in that way, it's always nice to go, and they really know what they're doing, and the volunteers and all that stuff, and they're great. But yeah, I agree. Like, I don't know. I feel like there were a lot of good movies. I hesitate using the word underwhelmed. I feel like it's a little overly negative, but I'm definitely coming away more curious about which films are going to percolate, as opposed to kind of feeling like we know which ones will, you know? So that's kind of an interesting place to be, which is not always the case, I feel like, after Sundance.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Call Me By Your Name premiered at Sundance, correct?
That is correct, yep.
Okay, so are there going to be any movies like that that like we can look forward to just like hearing about nonstop for a full goddamn year before it actually comes out? Or are these going to be more like of the quiet ones that pop up every now and then? People are like, oh yeah, that played at Sundance.
Well, I'll talk about, I mean, do you want me to lead right into my number one? Because that is actually one of the more interesting, the way it is going to be distributed is kind of interesting.
Yeah, so, do it.
I can talk. So, okay, so, yeah, my favorite film of the festival was The Tale, which is a film by Jennifer Fox, who has been a documentarian for the last many decades. And so this is a narrative drama that she directed and starring Laura Dern, who plays Jennifer Fox. And it's about how she kind of remembers her past and realizes that this first love she had was actually of a much older man, and she was much younger than she thought. And it kind of turns into the story of sexual abuse and what happens when your memories don't really align with reality. She receives a letter in the mail or a call from her mother saying that she found a letter in her place where she grew up. And her mom stumbled across this and read it and had never seen it before. And it kind of details this letter she said was fake when she was writing it for her English class, but it was actually kind of a really detailed account of this relationship she was in with her running coach and another woman. And it's just the movie kind of, it's the first half kind of feels like a very like Lifetime-y movie in terms of just the way it's shot and how things are set up. And even some of the dialogue is a bit stilted, but it gets to this place that is so kind of takes over. Like I was in a state of shock at the end of this film, the way it kind of progresses and where the story goes. And just some really interesting things with memory. I know Majority Prime last year, a great film, also dealt with this, but this obviously the subject matter here is very different. And so, for example, just like one scene, Laura Dern is remembering these events, and we see flashbacks of her as a child, and she thinks she's 15 and kind of more mature and just has more agency. And then you realize in the letter she was actually 13, and the flashback changes, and you see a younger version of herself, and it kind of hits you in the gut just how vulnerable and young she actually was when this happened. And so the big, though, story of this film is it was picked up by HBO Films and will not even be in theaters or going for Oscars at all. It'll just be an Emmy consideration. Huh. So technically it's my favorite film from Sundance, but for most people it might not even be considered a film at the end of the year, which is interesting.
That is interesting. Why is that? Like, why did... Do we know?
I think there's two reasons. I think it might be why HBO Films might have picked this up rather than a theatrical distributor. I think I didn't go to the premiere, but I was at the press screening, and a lot of people were kind of streaming out during these really difficult scenes where sexual abuse is depicted in a very realistic sense. And I think just selling that and mounting a marketing campaign for months and months leading up to it is not an easy sell, getting people in the theater. Mm-hmm. So with a platform like HBO, you know, with a click of a button, anyone can watch it. And if you want to pause it, obviously, if it's something that is triggering or you're just too intense for you, that you can easily just, you know, don't feel like you're wasting your money. And then I think I think, though, on the flip side of that, the experience of kind of being trapped in the film is what gives it a lot of power. You're kind of, I don't think I would have gotten the same effect if I kind of was watching this in doses on HBO. Like, I literally sat like in tears at the end of this movie, just kind of shocked and didn't get up. You know, almost every other Sundance movie, you're sprinting to the next screening, and here I just waited till the entire credits went by and kind of sat there in just a state of shock. And I don't think you're going to get that if you're obviously watching it in bit meal pieces, but or piecemeal. Yeah. So yeah, that's interesting.
Dan, did you see this movie?
I did not see The Tale, but obviously this was one of those movies that everybody who saw, like Jordan saying, definitely had a visceral reaction to. So I'm looking forward. I'm looking forward to watching it on HBO Go when it comes out. So,
it's coming out yet?
No, they haven't said yet.
Nah, damn it. This is, I don't know. This is I kind of wish that they would just snap it up and say, like, it'll be there tomorrow.
More and more, though, this is the way it is, right? I mean, I feel like, you know, with the Netflixes and Amazons and HBO obviously trying to kind of turn the corner in their own way, you know, there is a lot of this. I mean, we were talking before we recorded A Futile and Stupid Gesture, which is the David Wayne movie about National Lampoon, Doug Kenny specifically. That movie premiered at Sundance, but I watched it on Netflix on Friday, right? Yeah. So there is that element that's kind of continues to expand, right? So, you know, it's part of the deal, I feel like, with this with the way that media is being delivered. So it's not too, I mean, my number one, I guess, to segue, it would be a shame not to see it on the big screen, so this is the counterpoint. But the Zellner Brothers is Damsel, which stars Robert Pattinson and Mia Wasikowska. That movie is beautiful. It's basically it's a Western that has some subverted themes. Very funny movie. And obviously, you know, they filmed that movie in Utah, in the mountains, and to see it on as big of a screen as possible would be great for anybody, you know, listening who is interested. These guys did the Kumiku, the Treasure Hunter, which was at Sundance a couple of years ago, I think. Which,
yeah.
Did you not like that, Brian? You guys covered it, right?
I can't remember. we did cover it, and I just remember I had a very visceral reaction to that movie because I was just so upset that, like, she was, that no one was stopping her, that, like, everything just kept happening. And right. I think it was an effective movie, but I'm not sure that I wasn't sure how I was supposed to read everything that was going on. And I just had, like, a very visceral reaction to, like, this poor woman, why is no one stopping her?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the tone they deal in, I think, just as filmmakers. This is, I feel like, a little more accessible than Kumiku. It's definitely a little less tragic, a little more funny, definitely kind of tragic comedy in some ways, but the focus is on Wasikowska and what she's doing, and she's giving an amazing performance. So that was kind of my, I had a weird festival, you know, a lot of the movies kind of, my experience was kind of right down the middle, which, you know, maybe blame it on 4 movies a day, or, you know, this being the 8th festival for me, or just general cynicism. But I do think I happen to see a lot of movies that I felt were good, not great, kind of like what Jordan was saying. And Damsel was kind of a pleasant surprise for me about halfway through our viewing, you know, our viewing days. So I'm looking forward. I don't know if it's gotten picked up or not yet, but I'm looking forward to wherever they go. Yeah. So
it should be.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it will be, but, nothing yet, but, you know, I hope it does get a theatrical release, in that case.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I'm still thinking about The Tale just because of the, Call Me By Your Name episode that we had.
Oh, I was thinking it a lot. Cause I listened to that, like, right before I saw this, and It definitely treats that with much more insight than obviously Call Me By Your Name does, which is a different film, but.
Yeah, Michael texted me over the Slack channel and was just like, so have you heard about The Tale? That's going to be a fun episode. And I was like, oh my God, I can't even imagine. You know, even though it's going to HBO, I would say anyone listening at home, stay tuned. It's going to be.
Oh yeah, you guys, you'll definitely want to discuss this one.
Fantastic. Sure. All right, so you've both done your top ones. Why don't you give us the next step down? What was your like second runner up for the festival?
So for me it was Wildlife, which is the directorial debut from Paul Dano, who co-wrote the film with Zoe Kazan, his partner. And Paul Dano has worked with PTA, Ryan Johnson, Ang Lee, just like so many, Denis Villeneuve, Stephen McQueen. So he's clearly had a lot of time to prep for this, and just watching these other directors. And this film, actually, what I like most about it is that it kind of is almost more akin to his Meek's Cut Up director, Kelly Reichardt, and a little bit of Ang Lee thrown in. It's a much more patient film than perhaps some other directors that he's worked with, if he gleaned anything from them. And this is a story of Carey Mulligan and Jake Gyllenhaal living in Montana in 1960. And Jake Gyllenhaal loses his job and decides to go fight fires near the Canadian border. And Carey Mulligan is left with their child, played by, I think, Ed Oxenbold is his name. And he's actually the kid from The Visit. And he's in a much more mature, just a few years later. This is a much more mature performance.
No rapping this time?
No rapping at all. But the thing that impressed me most was just every kind of, camera movement, every kind of gesture in this film, like there was some sort of intention behind it. It's a very patiently unfolding movie, but just insanely well scripted. There's, subtext between every line as kind of Carey Mulligan finds this newfound sense of freedom in her life. And you're kind of seeing everything from her child's perspective, who's, he clearly still loves his dad, but his dad's gone. And now Carey Mulligan kind of decides that she wants to take certain things into her own hands. And it's just a very subtle, beautiful movie. A lot of people called it slow, so I think it's just adds to its greatness.
Right up my alley, yeah.
I just remember at the end of Certain Women, everyone around me was like, nothing happened in that movie. And that kind of is the same vibe here almost. There's more, obviously, narrative going on, but
right.
If you love that kind of movie and you think there is a lot of going on, then you'll find a lot going on here too. It kind of reminded me of like, a really great focus features film from like 10 to 15 years ago. If that is a compliment for you, then you'll like it. just, very solid kind of family drama. That hasn't actually been picked up either, but I would be shocked if it doesn't get picked up. And I would assume it would be like a kind of a fall release. It seems like it could go for some awards.
All right. Dan Mecca, what about yourself?
I saw a little movie called Nancy, starring Andrea Riseborough, and directed by Christina Cho, I believe is how you would say that last name. And it's basically, the premise is a 35-year-old woman living in kind of upstate New York, like Oswego, New York. She comes to realize that she may have been abducted when she was a child, and the woman she's been living with for the last 30 years may not be her mother. She sees a news report. About this couple who lost their little daughter 30 years ago, and they have a composite photo of what that young girl would look like today, and it looks a lot like Andrea Riseborough. But early on, we kind of learn – her name's Nancy. She's the titular character. Early on, we kind of learn that she is a bit of a liar. So it does muddle this situation of, is she trying to maybe pull one over on this couple? Because, she reaches out to this couple, and, Steve Buscemi is the dad. And then the mother is played by an actress who looks familiar, but I'm looking up the name right now.
Jay Smith.
Yeah, played by J. Smith Cameron. And they're the couple that lost their child, Steve Buscemi and J. Smith Cameron. And the movie is really a three-hander. It's Nancy reaches out to them, and they, they're basically waiting on DNA results and trying to convince themselves that this is maybe their daughter. The Buscemi character is a little bit more hesitant. The Cameron character is a little bit less hesitant. So it's an interesting dynamic. And Andrea Riseborough, she was in like 4 Sundance movies, I think. Mandy. Yeah. Was it Mandy, Nancy, Burden, which I also saw, and a 4th one, which I can't place right now, I believe. So she was all over the festival and basically giving completely different performances in every single movie, and really just speaks to her unbelievable talent. So I'm hoping
just in the newest season of Black Mirror too, wasn't she?
I don't know.
Is she, Crocodile?
Yeah. Yep, the black and white one, right?
Yeah. No. Yes. No. I'm not sure.
Let's see. I'm looking it up. But anyway, she's great, and I'm happy this movie got a lot of attention, and I'm hoping it gets, I'm hoping it gets noted and gets picked up and gets a proper release. And yes, she was in Crocodile in Black Mirror.
Nice. This is a question, I guess, from my cousin who knows an actor who's in Burden. How was Burden?
So Burden I liked. I think it won a prize, a drama prize today as we're recording Sunday, end of the festival, for those listening in the future. But Burden. I like Burden. She's the best part of Burden. Not surprisingly, it was written, directed by this once actor, Andrew Heckler, who I think spent a long time trying to get this movie made. A lot of people at the festival, I think, struggled with basically the premise of Burden. It's about this guy, Mike Burden, who's a real guy, and he's a former Ku Klux Klansman. And basically, he opens a redneck shop in this town in South Carolina, I believe. And his surrogate father figure, played by Tom Wilkinson, is a big KKK guy. But basically, he falls in love with the Andre Riseborough character, and there's a preacher in the town, played by Forrest Whitaker, who he begins to befriend, and he has a change of heart about being a racist. And, you know, it's the real story to some degree. Mike Burden's a real guy. It's interesting. It's way too long. And the focus on Mike Burden as opposed to the Reverend, I think, was a sore spot for some people who watched it, just because, you know, this movie in so many ways is about religion, in the sense of Forrest Whitaker is the true sense of a Christian, right? Which is, he embraces Mike Burden and wants to help him and understand him and vice versa. And his unlimited compassion is really effective. And the fact that the movie kind of spends more time on this racist is interesting. I think I like the complexity of it. I think it's doing a lot. Garrett Hedlund plays Mike Burden. Yeah. He's doing a lot of acting. I like most of it. And I think ultimately the whole thing works. So I'm curious what happens with it. I mean, I would imagine they'll do an awards push. I don't know if it's gotten picked up yet. I don't think it has. So we'll see.
No, not yet.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see. I mean, it's one of those things, you know, it could really go either way. Right. I mean, you know, like Birth of a Nation was a couple years ago, and obviously that went, sideways when all the stuff came out regarding, Nate Parker. So you never know. I mean, that movie was huge at Sundance, and obviously, like I just said, kind of disappeared. This is a bit of a harder way to tell a story like this, obviously. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. Whitaker's great. And Usher Raymond is in it, and actually really good. Yeah, he's like, has a pretty central role and is really good, actually, which is nice to see. Always kind of nice to see something like that. So, yeah, I recommend it, you know, semi-hesitantly, but I do.
Interesting. Yeah, my cousin like tweeted at me, and he was like, "Hey, my man, he's friends with Dexter Darden." He was like, "Oh, this movie Burden. Let me know if it's good." And I was like, "I don't go to Sundance, man. I'm not important enough." But I'll.
What are you talking about?
Dexter Darden has he's got a big part. He's got a big part in the movie. I think he plays. Yeah, he plays Forrest Whitaker's the Reverend's son. So he's in a lot of the movie. Man, he's good. He's good too. So
excellent. All right. Well, Thomas, that's for you. You're listening, buddy. It doesn't matter. I was gonna say I'm gonna see him in 2 weeks. I'll tell him to listen to this. Jordan Raup.
Yes. So I'm gonna cheat a little bit and do a little double feature. Two skateboarding films of very different stripes. One is called Skate Kitchen, which is Crystal Moselle. She did The Wolf Pack a few years ago, which I thought had kind of a good hook, but didn't love the movie. And this one is fantastic. It's just hanging around these badass like teenage girls in Manhattan's Lower East Side as they as they skateboard and talk about life. And it's like a, it's almost like a good version of American Honey, I would say, Brian, which could pique your interest.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's like if American Honey wasn't so caught up with the kind of the socioeconomic parts of the characters and kind of signaling their fate almost throughout the movie, this one is just kind of buries into the kind of passion these girls have for their craft of skateboarding, and amazingly shot, just really vibrant and beautiful. And then on the flip side, there's another skateboarding film. This one's a documentary, and it won an award last night. And it's called Minding the Gap, and it's about this filmmaker who grew up as a skateboarder with two friends. His name's B. Lou, and he has these two friends in Rockford, Illinois, who just kind of hung back and continued their lives while he went on to kind of pursue filmmaking and his passions. And these two kids are, you know, they're in their 20s, and one of them has a child, and it's kind of about, you know, the growing up in a way, but also friendship and kind of what happened in your teenage life and how it kind of reverberates throughout. We learn about certain kind of domestic abuse situations with almost all the kids, and it's kind of you know, sad but also uplifting that their friendship has continued. And Dan saw this with me, and I think he enjoyed it too, right, Dan?
Sorry, I was muted. I did like it a lot. And it's one of those docs, Minding the Gap, that it's surprising, like it's starkly honest, which I suppose, you know, is what you want from a documentary. It's definitely, you know, the director definitely kind of, it feels like sidesteps some moments because these are people he grew up with, but also in a lot of ways doesn't. And I think it's really stayed with me more than most movies I saw actually at Sundance after watching it. So big recommend from me, definitely.
All right.
Cool.
So Dan Mecker, what was your number three film of the fest?
You know, I guess, so I don't really have a number three because it was kind of like what I said before. There, a lot of them were kind of in the center, but I'll rail off a couple real quick. I mean, Ethan Hawke directed a movie called Blaze, which is about this artist who passed away in the 80s called Blaze Foley, kind of a country blues guy. And that stars Alia Shawkat and this musician Ben Dickey. That's a good movie. It's a little too long, but it's very lyrical and it's very beautiful. And Ethan Hawke has a sure hand as a director. And for the music alone, it's worth it. And Shawkat's unbelievable. And I wrote that review and I pointed that out. So that was one. And then there's a movie called Search, which a lot of people liked a lot. And that stars John Cho and Deborah Messing. And it's a gimmick where the whole movie basically takes place on a computer screen. So it's John Cho's, like, he's basically searching for his daughter. And it's all through, you know, FaceTime and email.
It's like
and
the drama version
Google
of
Map.
Unfriended.
Yeah, I suppose. And it's good. It's super silly, right? It gets a little, you know, not surprisingly, I guess, not unsurprisingly, it gets a little ridiculous, but it's super entertaining.
Most high concept movies like that go a little nuts towards the end usually.
Yeah, basically at the halfway point, it gets to a place where you kind of see what's happening and you got to like either, not unlike something like The Commuter, I suppose, right? Where the formal stuff is impressive, but the narrative stuff maybe suffers. But that's okay if you're into it. And I really hope he continues to get these lead roles because he really is an asset in this world. And then the last thing was a movie I liked more than most. I feel like a lot of people didn't like this as much. This movie, Ophelia, starring Daisy Ridley.
Oh,
it's an Australian.
I heard on Twitter terrible things about that.
Yeah. I liked it a lot. A lot of people didn't. It's an Australian movie. It's her, Daisy Ridley plays Ophelia from Hamlet. It's a retelling of the story, basically from her point of view. And it kind of, it's almost like a proto-feminist telling of Hamlet, right? Where she takes a lot more agency in the decisions and what have you. I went with it. I liked it a lot. There's a lot of cool costumes. It's crazy. It gets really hammy at the end. The performances are over the top.
Is it like a comedy, like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead? Like, is meta self-aware, or is it?
Well, I don't know that it's meant to be a comedy. I definitely enjoyed it in the way of something like that. I mean, I felt it was ridiculous, but you know, whether or not that was the intention, it didn't really matter to me. I enjoyed myself.
Right.
I think a lot of people, probably rightfully so, didn't feel that way. I don't know. Whatever. I mean, Clive Owen's in this. He's got this ridiculous wig. He's just like chewing ham on screen. And so he's playing the, you know, the Claudius, right? So, you know, there's a lot of shit like that. You know, it's fun. I liked it a lot. I hope it gets picked up. I hope somebody puts it out. I hope people hate it and then love it in 5 years, you know, type of thing.
Interesting.
And that's, you know, there's other stuff I saw, but those are the things as I kind of talk that really jumped out. There's another movie, Hearts Beat Loud. That's getting a lot of play, directed by Brett Haley. He made a movie I love last year called The Hero, which is also at Sundance, with Sam Elliott. This is not as good as that, but it's very charming. It takes place in Red Hook, Brooklyn, and it's about Nick Offerman and Kirstie Clemons, her father and son, and they play music, and it's about family and time changing, and there's many songs, and it's very easy to like. And, you know, Gunpowder and Sky picked it up, and I think Sony got the worldwide rights, so that'll definitely be around. And I hope people like it, and they love it. Take your mom to see it, and your dad, too. And that's all I got for now.
I'm curious, did either of you see Hereditary?
Yes, both did. We can talk about that.
Okay, because I'm like, as a person who's kind of on the outskirts, again, stranded in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. while everyone else goes and has fun in the snow, this is a movie that I feel like is one of the ones that I heard the most about in terms of just general noise. And so I'm curious what your thoughts are. It was it produced by A24 or was it picked up by A24?
They produced it. Okay. Yeah, and then it's going to come out in June. I actually just published my review of it on the film stage, and Dan and I saw this together. Dan saw it through his fingers as he was
very scared at movies.
Not even horror movies. Like, you watched The Intern and you were frightened.
I was frightened of Adam Devine's or Levine, whatever his name is, his beautiful comedy. No, I'm a scaredy cat, and as the older I get, the scareder I get, and Jordan can attest to that.
Yeah.
This movie was scared.
Yeah. Yeah. It does an amazing job at kind of building tension and setting this groundwork that's more about the family relations than any sort of supernatural thing. I mean, the scariest scene in the film has nothing to do with anything sort of supernatural. And that kind of happens in the first act or first, you know, half. And I think it's a really solid horror film. I think Toni Collette is amazing in it, and so is Alex Wolff playing her son. I just think it kind of gets to be, by the end, just throwing a lot at you and not in a way that is so coherent as the first two-thirds were. Mm-hmm. And it kind of, I mean, almost like in a Kill This way, it kind of just gets, but not in like a fun kind of what the hell are we doing now, more kind of like almost getting bogged down a little bit too much with kind of exposition by the end. It just kind of goes for this like WTF territory that it kind of loses that kind of grounded connection that it built up so well. But definitely this director, I mean, this is his first film, which is insane.
Ari Aster is
his name. Yeah. It's solid though. I mean, it's very much in the vein of almost even like The Witch in terms of like production design and just kind of a sense of darkness running throughout it. But obviously this takes place. Yeah, exactly. I guarantee it will make, you know, more money than It Comes at Night, but they will probably sell it like that.
Which is another A24 film.
Exactly. That's what I'm. So yeah, that was solid.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think
I'm looking forward to it.
Our pal and condo mate Eric D. Snyder said it really well, I believe, on his podcast, where he was talking about this movie, which he loved. And he said how it's a horror movie in two ways, in which horrible things happen in the movie that just on a personal level are horrifying to watch. And then also it is a horror film in the genre sense. So you have this thing of the movie starts in one way. And these things happen that just even in a stark drama would be, you know, disturbing, and then it becomes another thing. So, in that way, it's very entertaining. I was very scared. Toni Collette's giving probably like one of the best performances of her career. I mean, she's so good in this movie. She's the mother who's, you know, basically one of the, basically the lead, one of the leads of the movie. And, yeah, I mean, for her alone, it's worth seeing. So I'm excited to see kind of what the world thinks of it.
And I'll talk quickly maybe about two more horror films that were kind of highly talked about. One is Mandy, which is the long-awaited return of Beyond the Black Rainbow director Panos Cosmatos. This is Nicolas Cage going full tilt insanity. And many people might think, why do I need to see this again? Well, I think this one, he actually has a director that matches his insanity level. If you guys have seen Beyond the Black Rainbow, it's just this kind of kaleidoscopic, LSD fueled kind of trip. And this movie kind of has more of a backbone in the script and a better foundation to, so when the crazy shit hits the fan, that it actually, there's kind of a, more of a narrative thrust behind it. So yeah, this stars Nicolas Cage and Andrea Riseborough, as Dan mentioned previously. And, I'm surprised it actually hasn't gotten picked up yet. But it's just this beautiful, shocking, just, insane film. A lot of people kind of turned off by the first hour, where it's really nothing of horror happens. It's more about setting the stage. And as someone who really loved Beyond the Black Rainbow, I kind of expected that. So I knew going in. But yeah, I would say temper your expectations that it's not just 2 hours of Nicolas Cage screaming, which happens at the end of this. But, oh, and Brian, you'll enjoy this. He has a scene that's not unlike Rooney Mara eating the pie and A Ghost Story, but this time it's a whole bottle of vodka.
Oh my god, that's something I can identify with even more.
And then one of my least favorite films, which was one of the most beloved at the festival, was Assassination Nation.
I heard that got picked up, and like people were saying like, "Oh, best of the fest," and then like almost immediately, the backlash was like, "Oh my god, what are you fucking talking about?"
Yeah, it got bought by $10 million by Neon, and then the Russell Brothers new company. They joint distribution, and yeah, I mean, this is a movie where it's literally just the modern day kind of Salem witch trials, but for a social media age. But it's so, I think, trying to do so much in every single scene it's trying to be about today that, like, I don't think really it accomplishes anything by the end. You just kind of walked away feeling a little dirty and disgusted. And there are moments of kind of fun, whether it's kind of the moment of vengeance. I mean, it's about this, you know, group of four or five teenage girls who all of their information gets leaked online. And so including, you know, sexting, text and browser history and everything. And this kind of town goes against them, calling them whores and things like that. And so they mount this blood fueled vengeance on the town. And I wish the movie was as fun as that sounds. It's kind of a strange thing where the director kind of seems to revel in like depicting their acts before in this kind of peevish way. And then by the end, he's kind of trying to point the finger at you. And it just kind of feels, you know, he kind of revels also in like the torture aspects. And it just is kind of an ugly, unpleasant film. And, you know, I don't think movies need to necessarily, what they're showing, they're not endorsing it, I don't think, but this movie just felt too tipped in one scale and didn't have the intelligence of a director who could kind of land the message home. So yeah, I mean, teenagers might like this and get more out of it. I might be too old now to really appreciate this, but but yeah, I just didn't. I mean, in the moment, I was kind of having a little bit of fun, but by the end, it was just kind of like, all right, this is not a good film whatsoever. So probably in like August and make some money and then not be talked about again. And then I can do real quick. I'll just mention, you know, I saw the top prize winner, The Miseducation of Cameron Post, which is Desiree Akhavan, who did Appropriate Behavior 3 years ago. She returns with this time a less personal story. This one's an adaptation of a coming of age novel about Chloe Grace Moretz's character, who goes, she has a relationship in high school and with a girl, and she gets caught on prom night making out in the backseat of a car. And so her conservative parents sent her to homosexual conversion camp, mm-hmm. You know, Mike Pence style. And And yeah, and it is, it's a solid film. It's very like, if anyone who saw Appropriate Behavior knows that this is a director who can really key into kind of just the humanity of any situation. And this, she certainly does so here. And there's a lot more humor than I would have expected here. And it's kind of more, almost, it's almost more tragic for these kind of Christian camp counselors who just seem like they are just kind of lost in the weeds and don't, and are, you know, always contradicting themselves and things like that. And if they're almost depicted as more, you know, more tragic than even the main characters in a sense, because Chloe Grace Moretz never for a moment kind of doubts that she is a lesbian and will continue doing that after this. So it's just kind of about, it's almost a wackier situation for them. And then for these counselors, it's, you know, like I said, more tragic. And so that's kind of an interesting angle, but I just felt there was kind of a personality lacking in both the direction and the lead performance that you just didn't sell this as much as I was hoping for. You don't kind of feel the emotion that Chloe Grace Moretz is going through. You feel it's, everything's kind of felt at a distance, which is unfortunate because I really, really did like her last film. But it's still, it's okay. It's solid. It has also not been picked up yet, but I assume it will be soon.
It's a terrible title, though.
Yeah. I guess so.
It's based on a novel, right?
Yeah, based on a novel.
So,
I'm one of those weird people. Like, yeah, I hate certain title architecture. And the blank of blank is usually one of them. It's the same thing of like, I don't like when you take a profession and then like say that the novel is like the time traveler's wife or the abortionist's daughter or something like that. It's just like, I doubt
they will change this title, Brian. I'm sorry.
Well, then I'm going to never see this movie. no, actually it sounds interesting. Chloe Grace Moretz. So,
yeah. And then there's a bunch of notable films that I didn't mention that are very solid that will definitely be talked about. I'll just really quickly mention them. Deborah Granick returned after, 8 years since Winter's Bone with a movie called Leave No Trace. It's a really, really solid father-daughter story about Ben Foster and then this newcomer, Tomas McKenzie, I believe her name is. And they kind of live off the grid, Captain Fantastic style. But this is much more grounded and heartfelt than that film, I think. And it's just a very solid story about what happens when they are forced to be introduced to society and how their relationship shifts. So very solid. And then A24 had a film called Eighth Grade, which is Bo Burnham's directorial debut. And it's about obviously an eighth grader who's kind of an outcast and how she tries to fit into her high school, getting ready for high school. It's the last week of middle school, and it's kind of about that transition period. And it's very solid again, didn't really stand out too much, but just really well written. And then two other quick ones, Private Life, Tamara Jenkins, her first film in a decade. She last did The Savages with Philip Seymour Hoffman and Laura Linney, and here she returns with Catherine Hahn and Paul Giamatti, and it's about they're a couple in their early 40s trying to get pregnant, and it's just about their struggle. Really well observed, very grounded, really solid film that Netflix will be putting out later this year. And then one that a lot of people went crazy over called Madeline's Madeline, which is Josephine Decker's new film. And it's about it was in the next category, and it does feel very much, which is a category kind of for smaller films that are kind of pushing boundaries in a sense, and this film was probably the best example of that, I think, in that category. And it's about the girl who is kind of torn between her theater coach and her mother, played by Miranda July, and the film places you right inside of her head in very literal ways. Kind of you see her perspective in a lot of the movie, and she has mental illness, but also is just this incredible performer. And it's about how the theater coach kind of uses her story and exploits it in a way in this theater production they're doing. And it kind of sounds very cliche and very Sundancey, but the way Josephine Decker shoots it and just the script, it ends up in this kind of exhilarating place where you literally don't know what, you know, the next shot's going to be for the last half of the movie. And it's just very, really one of the most thrilling last halves of a movie. So in another year, it might have been one of my favorites, but I do want to see it again. It's the type of movie you'll want to see right away. So I think that's the bulk of the big stuff. Right. Any other questions you had, Brian, about movies?
No, not really. I was going to see if DJ Mecca had anything to add on. You know, I never remember to have an air horn ready when you're on.
I know, which is such a shame of you to not do that.
I know.
It's really just...
I'm an idiot.
So I'll just mention this because it won the grand jury for prize for documentary. I saw Kailash, which I'm probably mispronouncing, but it's a Derek Donnan. He directed this movie, this doc, which is about this guy named Kailash who is a human rights activist. His name's Kailash Satyarthi. And basically he is leading this campaign to end child slavery for years and years and years. And the movie's about that campaign, about these children that he rescues from child slavery, where they're working in factories, and he'll like raid the factories and, officials in India, I think primarily is where a lot of the action takes place. And he'll save these children and try to, convict these factory owners and these people who are, kind of making it this industry. And it's interesting. I'm happy it won the award. I hope it gets seen by a lot of people. I wish it was a better documentary, which sounds like kind of a weird criticism, but it's a little thin. I almost wish the movie was told by this activist primarily, as opposed to it's a very standard made doc, right? There's like animation when he's telling a story about a thing that happened that they don't have footage for. And then a lot of the footage that they do have, it feels like it's half there. And I feel bad even criticizing it because it's so hard to make documentaries like this. And I do hope it gets seen. But I did want a little bit more from it, but that said, I'm happy that it exists and hopefully it kind of gets a nice platform. But, yeah, that one. So hopefully, it has a second life after this festival.
All right. Excellent. Well, gentlemen, thank you for coming and sharing all of this with us, all of us plebes who couldn't be there at Park City. Are you looking forward to going next year?
Do it.
Did you say do it? I think Jordan...
Do it, yeah.
Do it like Brian should come? Is that what you're saying? What do you say?
Oh, I thought Brian said it. He looks forward to going next year.
No, I said, are you looking forward to going next year? And then I thought you just do it. Like, yeah, I'm not going.
Yeah,
I have like,
I guess so.
I have like very little interest in ever going to Sundance for some reason. Like of all the festivals, it's the one that I usually care about and like fantasize about the least. And I don't know why that is. Because many films that I have loved have come out of Sundance. Slam Dance. I mean, that's the one for me.
Slam Dance, yeah. You have to kind of pick. Usually, the less star power, the more interesting the film is on some level. So, we've talked to you for many years about our experiences now.
Yeah. And I look forward to the next time and the time after that and all the other stuff. So that's all for today. Hopefully everyone at home has enjoyed this rundown of the Sundance Film Festival. Usual ending stuff, patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. Go there and give us your money. Also, don't forget to check out Mubi, where they have a Sundance selection happening right now. Talking about things like Room 237 and Ain't Them Body Saints getting some airplay. So check that out. Also, don't forget that Lover for a Day is in theaters now. So go to loverforaday.mubi.com to find out where that is playing. Yep. And go to MUBI.
I will say if you're in New York City and you come to see it, it is playing at my workplace. So tweet me. And if it's during the workday, I'll come say hi to you.
Oh,
I'd love to meet a film stage listener.
It is possible that you will meet someone who listens to the film stage faster than you met the actual host of the film stage.
That's my dream right there.
Yes. Anyway, go to mubi.com/filmstage and you will get a free 30-day trial of Mubi. And that's about it. That's all for today. So we can wrap up and tell the fine people at home where we can be found. So let's start with DJ Mecca.
Oh, you did it. Oh. I love it. Oh, that was nice. You can find me at the Film Stage. I have a bunch of Sundance reviews up. I have a couple more coming. And then my Twitter handle is DJ Mecca on Twitter, but I just said twice. And that's it, right? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Around.
Yeah. I'm going to be posting, hopefully by tomorrow, a feature on like running down every single review we did and the best of the best and the worst of the worst. So, and everything in between. So you can click that.
So that's the only place you're going to tell people to find you?
They know already.
It's JP Rao on dude. Twitter. You just told people to tweet at you if you were good, if they were going to be going to see the movie.
Now I got the Sunshine music playing right now?
Yeah.
No, it's not. No, it's not playing anymore.
No, oh, it's still playing. There, see?
I got a Sundance. I got it.
Yes. I just chose songs that had sun in or around them. If the Beatles weren't so good with their copyright, you would have heard Here Comes the Sun. Anyway, I am, of course, Brian J. Rowan on Twitter and everywhere else, Letterboxd, Instagram, blah, blah, blah. And you can find my writing and all the other episodes of the Film Stage show at thefilmstage.com, so check that out. This will be posting, and then either right before or right after it, you will actually be getting our Top 10 of 2017 episode with Bill and Mike and I, so don't forget to check that out. And we will be back with an actual review of a single movie in the week to follow. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us, and tune in next time.